My name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 167. I'm recording it on Saturday, September 19th, 2009. The P10 level today is 19. That's not great. The long-term value proposition of stocks is not as bad as it was before the stock crash, but dubious all the same. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Morning Snowflake. One of my sentimental favorites. This is a special podcast. And I felt I needed some special music. And so I looked into my trunk of musical selections and I picked one that's always been a sentimental favorite, Morning Snowflake. And I this is not a well-known fact, but I've given consideration from time to time of renaming the website. The website's now known as PassionSaving.com. I thought of renaming it the Morning Snowflake site because I want to get back. My friend Petey Person had said that in the days before I told the truth about safe withdrawal rates, I was known as a puppy dog poster back at Motley Fool. And I think it would help the image of the site if I could be known as a puppy dog poster once again. And I think the key is using music like Morning Snowflake in my podcast. So we're using very special music today. The title of the podcast is Risk is Never, Never, Never Good. I don't like putting my investments at risk. Do you? No. I'm going to put my money at risk. I'm going to keep my money. I worked for my money. I'm going to keep my money. But those passive investing advocate types, what do they tell us? They say, if you take on more risk, you'll get more return. You got to take on risk. That's important. Well, they make risk sound like it's good. It's not. It's bad. Bad risk. Don't want risk. I think if you're going to try to learn how to invest effectively, you sort of have to understand the ABCs of the game you're playing. And the ABCs of the game are avoid risk. But this mixed up, topsy-turvy, convoluted, upside-down investing theory called passive investing gets everything backwards. And it tells us we want to take on risk. And don't say that I'm misquoting the passive investors, because I am not. I recall, and this was long before the great safe withdrawal rate debate. I think I told this story once before, but oh, it gets on my nerves every time I think about it. I was in a Borders back in the late 1990s. It was 98 or 99. And I was looking at magazines, personal finance magazines. I don't recall whether this was Money Magazine or Kiplinger's. I have a feeling it was Kiplinger's, but I can't say for sure. And they had a cover article on a topic that a lot of people ask about. I'm behind in my retirement planning. What should I do? How do I catch up? You know, a lot of people are in this situation and they're worried. And they gave I almost can't say what they said because it's so obscene. The advice was, I mean, I didn't read the whole article, but you turn to the page, and this was the whole article was on this theme. The idea was, or at least if maybe it was one of those five tip things, and it was the first tip, but you know, I didn't read the whole thing. But I'm not one of those people that goes into Borders and just sits there on the chair and reads all the magazines. But They said, here's what to do. You're behind in your retirement planning. Take on more risk. And what they mean by take on more risk is buy more stocks. It's whatever your stock allocation is, buy more. It's a funny little coincidence that 90% of the advertisers in these magazines are connected in some way with the stock selling industry. Surprise, surprise. I think that might have influenced the choice of topics or the choice of answers or the choice of tips given. I have a funny feeling. Take on more risk, which means buy more of this wonderful product we have called stocks, where we just happen to make a commission higher than we make on any of the alternatives available to you. I mean, what's aggravating about that is the whole idea that I mean, I love stocks, but the whole idea that you should always buy stocks is annoying. But the idea that the poor person who is, you know, it's like they just have no shame. The poor person who is behind in his retirement planning, he's already in a spot. He's already in a spot. And he's asking for help. And what you're telling him is take on more risk. Now, at the time, I mean, I was horrified at the time, but I hadn't, you know, created anything like the stock return predictor. Go look at the stock return predictor at the top of the bubble, January of 2000. Tips, Treasury inflation-protected securities were available at the time, a risk-free asset class, was available at the time, paying 4% real per year. Stocks, the most likely long-term return, was a negative 1% per year. So that meant this individual, to the extent he moved from tips to stocks, he was lowering his annual return by 5 percentage points per year for 10 years running. Do the math, and that means he was lowering his portfolio value in the year 2010 by 50%. Not counting compounding. If he had $100,000 at the start, and he put the money in tips, he'd have, you know, gain of $40,000 at the end of 10 years. If he put it in stocks, his most likely return was a loss of $10,000. So that's a difference of $50,000 on a portfolio of $100,000. And if the numbers are bigger, if it's $200,000, then he lowered his portfolio value by $100,000. And this is a guy that's in trouble. You know, it's like somebody's fallen out of a boat and they're crying out for a life raft, and the stock selling industry throws them an anchor. You know, here, buddy, we're sorry for your plight. This will help you to sink faster. You'll die quicker, and your misery will be over. There's some things that are just beyond the pale, and I don't say these people did this with deliberate intent. I don't think they did. I don't think the editors or the reporters did, whoever they were. But there are a lot of people who read these articles, and there are too many smart people in this world for people not to see this sort of thing. And people should be, you know, I mean, I do believe the efficient market theory was genuinely believed by a lot of people. I don't say different. The evidence is very strong that that's so, but the arrogance with which this advice was put forward is just breathtaking. Anyway, I had to vent about that a little bit, but the point here is the core error being made in that advice is that risk is good, and this is an error that is endemic to the passive investing model, the conventional investing advice of the last 30 years, the dominant model of today. And this is a problem. Risk is not a good thing. Risk is bad. And our common sense tells us this. Just as our common sense tells us stocks can't always be the best asset class, anybody with any common sense whatsoever knows that can't be true, that there's got to be some price at which stocks are no longer a good value proposition. Anyone who has common sense knows that. Well, anyone who has common sense knows Risk can't be a good thing. How can that be? We use the word, risk is not a complicated word. We all know what risk is. Driving drunk is risky, right? Is there anyone who would pay any attention to someone who claimed, well, being a little bit drunk could have, in other words, oh, I'm late. I have a dinner engagement. I'm late. What can I do? Well, here, take a few drinks before you hit the road. You'll get there quicker. The risk will help you. Is there anybody who would believe such insanity? Something that could kill you. And that's what they were telling this guy when they were telling him to take on more risk. How did we ever get into such a convoluted, screwed up investing model that we come to believe that the answer to our problems is taking on more risk? It's, you go to a counselor and you say, counselor, I'm having troubles in my marriage. What do I do? You have to communicate less with your spouse. This is in direct defiance of all common sense. How could risk be good? Please. Please. Preserve our sanity. But passive investing teaches this. And it's not as if they write an article and they say risk is good, because if they wrote an article saying risk is good, I think people would laugh at them. It's implicit. What they do is they say, oh, if you invest more in stocks, that's good. And you say, why is that? Because stocks are risky. And of course, the implication is risk is good. They're telling you invest more in stocks because stocks are more risky. And it's crazy. But they say it in this, sneering way. Like, they have information nobody else has, and you hardly dare to question them. And not to say they don't believe it. I know that millions believe this. I know this. I don't know that every single one of them. I can't see into their head, but it's clear as clear can be that there are many, many smart people, not dumb people, who believe this. How did we ever come to believe that risk was good? So this is the purpose of this podcast, is to dispel this idea that risk is good. Risk is never, never, never good. Now, I've done a number of podcasts on risk. Risk is just, all investing, all understanding of how investing work is built on understanding what risk means, because risk is just what it's about. In a way, that's what makes it an interesting subject, I've come to see. I had little interest in investing when I started, when I got involved in the Great Debate. And the one thing that does make it interesting to me, well, not the only thing, but there's more than one, but risk is actually interesting. When you're playing a game, you're playing a strategy game, Monopoly or Risk, or Hearts or whatever it happens to be. Strategy is essentially a question of taking on risk, taking on calculated risk, and that's what investing is. And I think sometimes that's a good way to think about it. Think about it as a game. And then so many people are intimidated, and they don't want to look at investing. They don't want to think about it, and their minds just black out. And if you can think about it as a fun thing, I'm going to go play Monopoly, or I'm going to, whatever games it is you like to play, poker, then you can wrap your mind around it. And it's just the same thing, it's not any more complicated, certainly not any more complicated than poker investing. So think about it that way. But I've done a number of podcasts on risk. I know I have one called something like Risk in the Real World. And I have one, Risk Versus Risk. And I have one, Stocks Are Not as Risky as Bonds. And I have one on the drawing table called Quantifying Risk. So I've done a number on risk. But and this podcast is sort of a follow-up to one where I touched on this question but fairly recently, but I didn't nail it very well. It was called The Time Price Connection. That wasn't too long ago. I did that one, but I keep trying to pin that down, the insight that I was aiming at there, because I don't feel I nailed it. But sometimes you have to record, you have to sort of do a rough draft in order to sharpen your thinking a little bit. But this is a maddening thing that the passive model, which is, you know, I was tempted to something I like to do is when I do podcasts is to start out in my title with the words, I was wrong. If I can come up with an area where I've said something wrong and I've changed my mind, use those words, because it's a deliberate attempt to do the opposite of what the passives do, to admit mistake, admit weakness, and try, aim for humility. Not easy for any of us. I considered doing that, but then I wanted the title to be a little more snappy. But I have talked about risk being a good thing. You know, this passive investing stuff is in the oxygen we breathe. It's just, you know, everywhere, and we sort of soak it in. And our language, sometimes I have to invent terms because our language is poisoned by it. It's a poisonous way of thinking about investing. It's just the more I learn about passive investing, the more I hate it. I hate passive investing. I'm not kidding you. There are things I love about it. Please understand, I'm going to do a podcast, or at least it's on the, I have one listed on my list, you know, things we've learned from the passive investors, something like that. And we've learned wonderful, wonderful things. So please don't understand. But the passive part is truly maddening. And it's so bad. It's not just a question of passive doesn't work. It's a question of passive renders you incapable of rational thought. It paralyzes your brain because you start thinking risk is good. And how can you help somebody? You know, it's like I'm saying, if you're driving a car, I'm trying to teach somebody how to drive. And what you want to teach them is, you know, you don't want to go too fast. You don't want to change lanes without letting people know. You don't want to go right behind the other car. You don't want to tailgate. And their answer is, oh, but that's risky. And the way to get where you're going quickly is to take on lots of risk. So I ought to tailgate. I ought to switch lanes. I got to do it secretly. I don't want anybody to know in advance. I got to go fast. Now, it's risky, isn't it? I mean, nobody speaks quite in that comical a way. But when you're talking to passive investing advocates, they say this kind of thing. They say, well, yeah, you know, you're behind in your retirement. Yeah, well, the thing you might want to do is take on more risk. In other words, lose more money. But why is it that smart people believe this? Well, there's a premise. See, you got to go back to the premise. You got to root out the premise. People don't like to talk about theory. They like to talk about, you know, give me a tip. But if you understand why the theory's wrong, you'll understand why the strategy tips that passive investing advocates offer are dangerous. The idea how they came to believe that risk is good, an insane idea standing on its own. They came to believe risk is good because they came up with a theory that the thing you are compensated for when you invest your money is taking on risk. And I'm going to challenge that. It's close enough to be true that it is enticing. But it can't be right. Risk cannot be good. And high returns, of course, are good. You see, there's a, how can I say it? I've always been aware of this contradiction, and I know that others are. You know, you go to the Bogleheads board or the Vanguard Diehards board, and there are intelligent people there, and they're aware of this contradiction, but people have a hard time articulating it, especially when, in the event that they happen to articulate it well, they get bricks thrown at them. But people know, it just doesn't make sense. They say, you should put most of your money in stocks, and you say, why? And they say, well, because they're risky. And you say, that seems like a funny reason to do that. I don't really like putting my money at risk. And they say, oh, but you'll get more returns. You get compensated. You'll get more returns if you take on risk. You say, okay, well, I do like good returns. Now you're starting to make some sense. Okay, I'll do that. I'll put my money in stocks because I like those returns. But wait a minute, I just have one question. One thing bothers me. You mentioned risk, and that means I might lose my money, right? I mean, isn't that right? Hey, well, no, not if you invest for the long term, you see. If you invest for the long term, then you can't lose your money. So, okay, I'm dumb. Please bear with me. I'm very, very dumb. I ask dumb questions. Very stupid person. I have money to invest, but I must have inherited it. I'm very stupid. I couldn't possibly have earned it. But I do have money, and I do have to invest it, and I have to ask this stupid question. You say there isn't really any risk because I'm investing for retirement. I'm only 30 years old, so retirement's 35 years off, so there really isn't any risk. But you said I only get good returns because I'm taking on risk. But if I'm not taking on risk, do I still get the returns? Oh, yeah, you get all the returns. Oh, yeah, of course, get all the returns. None of the risk. You get the returns because you're taking on risk, but you're not taking on any risk, but you get the returns. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the guy, they got a Nobel Prize for this, right? The guy who came up with this got a Nobel Prize. Is that true? Oh, yeah, Nobel Prize. Oh, yeah. Very smart people, very smart. Do you take on risk or do you not? If you don't take on risk, then stocks shouldn't be giving you good returns. If you do take on risk, you don't want to do it. Which is it? It's like, you know, they're talking out of two sides of their mouth. Stocks are the riskiest asset class on planet Earth, so they have the best returns, so you got to put all your money in them. But don't have to worry about losing your money because you're investing for the long term. Buy and hold. Are they risky or aren't they? Well, yeah, I did talk about this in one of the earlier podcasts. There are these different definitions of risk. And Warren Buffett, put his finger on it. The whole passive investing model, it all comes out of this efficient market theory, jizz jazz, which was cooked up in some classroom. Has no connection with how investing works in the real world. I shouldn't say no. It has just enough of a connection to fool people. But it's sort of like a mirror version. Everything they tell you is the opposite of how it really happens. But please consult the earlier 166 podcast for details. But the way they measure risk in passive investo world is volatility. See, what bugs them is we all know that the average long-term return on stocks in the US is 6.5% real. This is something I think everybody agrees. And I think everybody agrees that's a fantastic deal. So we all start out, it's sort of like the Garden of Eden, you know, it's like, well, okay, 6.5% real sounds good. Let's do it. And there obviously has to be a hitch, or at least they think there has to be. There has to be a hitch. Can't be that easy. And so they sort of say, well, what is the hitch? Why is it, you know, 6.5, all everything's great. We should all invest in stocks. 6.5 beats anything else. And so, you know, they've of course got this idea, you can't beat the market or what's the other one, there's no free lunch. So 6.5 real just sounds too good to the passive investing mind, which is a smart mind. You know, and I'm not being sarcastic at all. It is a smart mind. It's a logical, smart mind. And it says 6.5 is just too good, and they've got to come up with something. They've got to come up with a negative. They're just bound and determined. And so they say, okay, here's a negative. I found one. Volatility. The problem with stocks is, yes, they do give 6.5. And it's true. Please don't ever say that I said different. It's true. They do give 6.5. But there's volatility. You don't get 6.5 every year. Some years you get 30%. Sometimes you get negative 50. It's volatile. It's volatile. And so, because they were looking for the downside to stocks in their little classroom exercise, they said, well, the downside is this volatility, so risk is bad. So if volatility is volatility is bad and risk is bad, risk must be volatility. So they came up with this idea that risk equals volatility. And Warren Buffett did a wonderful job of pointing out the flaw here. He said, okay, risk is volatility. Interesting. If risk is volatility, I own two stocks, and one of them has gone up 200%. I paid $5 for both of them, $6 for both of them. Let's say $10. Let's make the math easy. I paid $10 for these two companies. And company A has gone up 200%. It's now worth $30. And company B has gone down 20%, now worth $8. Company A is much more risky than company B. Oh, it's so risky. It's so scary to be in company A. It just keeps going up and up and up, and I'm so scared. The heck would you be scared for if your money is tripled? Risk is not volatility. It's stupid. How stupid. Instead of getting the Nobel Prize, they should have got the stupid person prize. But volatility is not risk. It's not. Risk, and this is what Buffett said, risk is losing your money. The thing you don't want to do. You don't want to lose your money. So the company that goes down 20%, you lost money, so that there is some risk there. But the one that goes up, it's not a bad thing. So what the passive investors did at a very early stage was they started thinking about risk being volatility. And they also, you know, it's like they have all these premises floating around. And the premises are behind everything they say, all the advice they give. And one of the premises is, one of the premises, volatility equals risk, which is crazy. And another one is, volatility is the reason stocks give such high returns. So therefore, risk is the reason they give such high returns. It all does follow this mad logic. But that doesn't mean any of it is true in the real world. Volatility is not risk. Risk is losing money. But see, If they didn't have this premise where they changed risk into volatility, they'd have to say, the reason you get so much money in stocks is because they're risky, and risk is losing money. Well, then if you're saying the reason the returns are so big is because stocks are risky, but risk means losing money. Well, do you see the logic problem there? It's a clearer statement instead of clouding things up with this discussion of volatility. But it's also self-contradicting. You're saying stocks are the riskiest class out there, therefore they pay the highest returns, and therefore they also have the biggest losses. How can they pay the highest returns and also have the biggest losses? It's crazy. Having a return means not having a loss. You can't have one asset class that has the biggest returns and the biggest losses. But of course, there's a sense in which that's true of stocks. You have the biggest returns at some time periods and the biggest losses at other time periods. But in an overall sense, it can't be true that stocks have the biggest losses and also the biggest returns. It just can't be true. And so you really have to examine these premises. This is what the key to everything is. And it's hard because most of the discussions, you know, when I go on blogs, the discussion is always at this surface level. It's always at the strategy level, the tip level. And you question the tip, And I say, why do you say that? And then you go back to theory, and they don't want to talk about theory. They're like, oh, I decided that 10 years ago. You know, I decided that passive investing is everything 10 years ago. They don't want to reexamine it. But if you don't reexamine the theory, you can never get the strategy tip right. But either risk means losing money or it doesn't. And if risk means losing money, risk is bad. The title of the podcast, Risk is Never, Never, Never Good. Risk is bad. I'm going to say that and I'm going to stick to it. So I have to explain. If I'm going to say that risk is always bad, I have to explain. Well, I have to explain, first of all, how it can be that stocks have such high returns. And my answer to that one, I gave a couple podcasts back. Where I think I said it was called I Was Wrong. What was it called? I was saying what did I say at an earlier time? I wonder. It was something about there is no equity risk premium. I hope I recorded one with that title. Don't seem to have any notes on it. Is it gone? Yeah, here. Now I'm getting close, I think. I was wrong. There is no equity risk premium. I think it was 162. What I argued is, and what I tentatively believe, all of these podcasts are somewhat tentative, is that the return of stocks isn't determined in some marketplace where you agree to take on risk and therefore you're compensated more than if you had not agreed to take on risk. The 6.5 number is just it's the product of the productivity of the U.S. economy and nothing more and nothing less. And so it has nothing to do with taking on risk. That number is sort of set in stone. That's what the productivity of the U.S. economy generates for the companies, and if you're a stockholder, you own a share of those companies, so that's what you get. End of story. So you don't even have to go into all this risk stuff. It just unnecessarily complicates things. We know why the return is 6.5, because that's what the productivity of the U.S. economy dictates. There is no market force setting the price. So nobody's saying, oh, you're one of those smart people willing to take on risk, so we're going to give you 6.5, even though we give the dummies only 2 or 3 or 4 and give you 6.5. Anybody who wants to invest in stocks is going to get 6.5 because that's what the productivity of the U.S. economy generates. So it's nothing to do with risk. It just is, you know? And of course, this goes to this whole idea, there is no free lunch. The passive investing mindset cannot accept that there are just some things in the world that are, and they're beautiful and good. You know, a mountain, it just is. It's a free lunch. The ocean is a free lunch. You know, apple trees are a free lunch. And the 6.5% return on stocks is a so-called free lunch. You don't have to pay for it by taking on risk. It just is. You buy stocks, that's what you get. The mystery, frankly, is not the return. The return is simple. It's just you own a share of the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy generates that return, and that's what you get, buddy. The mystery is the volatility. Where did that come from? Why isn't it just 6.5 every year? If we were in a normal world, if we weren't all confused by this passive investing gibberish, we would all just expect to get 6.5 every year. We, of course, understand that the economy does not generate 6.5 every year, but I think the passive investors are right that investors can incorporate things into the price, not only what's happening this year, they can incorporate things happening in the future. And so since we know that the economy is going to recover in days to come, so that the average return will be back at 6.5. In other words, if we're in a recession, we're going to get lower than 6.5 for a few years. But that means there are going to be years following where it's going to be more than 6.5. We're going to make up for it. So if those future returns are incorporated into today's price, why can't we just get 6.5 every year? And we should. It's the humans that mess that up. It has nothing to do with volatility and risk and all this jizz jazz and all these prizes, these Nobel Prizes. It has to do with the humans get these crazy ideas in their head, and they drive prices up to insane levels, and then you can't get the 6.5 until you've paid back the money you borrowed in the late 1990s, when instead of getting 6.5, you were getting 30. Now we've got to pay that back, and it has nothing to do with, you know, some market force setting some price. The price is just set by the U.S. productivity. So the 6.5 has nothing to do with being willing to take on risk. It's just a fact. Now, the question is, though, stocks do seem, in a way, riskier. Now, I actually sort of question this. It's a funny thing, because people portray me as being anti-stock. I have always disputed it. I think I'm very much pro-stock, more pro-stock than the passive investors are. And that's proven by a podcast like the one, Stocks Are Less Risky Than Bonds. I don't argue that stocks are risky. I argue they're less risky. All that I say is, when they are overpriced, I don't even say they're risky when they're overpriced, really. I mean, I probably have said it, but I shouldn't. When you buy stocks at the top of the bull market, it's not that they're risky, it's that they're overpriced. In other words, it's not really right. I argued that people who bought stocks from 1996 through 2008 were making a terrible mistake. And I'm sure that if you went back, you would find places where I said stocks were risky. That's not really true. I probably should try to refrain from saying that. I'm not sure I can, because it's so much part of our language, it would be hard to do. But the reason stocks paid a bad return from 96 through 2008 isn't that they were risky. It's that they were just overpriced. There's no risk in it. Risk means you don't know what's going to happen. There was no risk. There was no uncertainty. Stocks were sure to provide a bad long-term return in those years. It wasn't that you were at risk. It's that you were certain, virtually certain, to do poorly. Not risk. There wasn't much risk to it. There was a little bit, you know, because we price is not the only thing that affects returns. It's if you go 20 years out, it's 78%. It gives, if you know the P10 level of stocks on the day you buy them, of a broad index, 20 years out, the return is 78% predictable. So 22% is unknown. So there is some risk, you know, there's sort of a continuum of possibilities. And at 10 years, there's more, because stocks are not as predictable at 10 as they are at 20. So there's, you know, you could call that risk, if you want to call it that. But it's not right to say that the reason why stocks were a poor value proposition is that they were risky. The way to say it is they were a poor value proposition because they were overpriced. They were no more risky. Risk means uncertain. They were no more uncertain. The returns were no more uncertain from 96 to 2008 than they are today, or than they were in 1982. 1982, the long-term value proposition was fantastic. But it was no less risky than it was at the top of the bubble. It's just, it was better priced, but it wasn't really more risky. Unless, if you define risk as, see, this is the thing. If you define risk as losing money, well, clearly your odds of losing money were far, far, far greater from 96 through 2008 than they were in 82. And that's the mistake we're making. We're not using our words precisely. We're calling something risk. We're sort of mixing it up. We're calling, sometimes we're just saying anything bad is risk. So losing money is risk. Even if you're certain to lose it, it's risk. You know, we're sort of slipping into that. And then at the other extreme, we're saying risk is good. We're saying, oh, if you're behind in your retirement plan, invest more in stocks because you want to take on more risk. That's the only way to get higher return. So we're using risk to cover everything. Risk is like the ultimate good and the ultimate evil at the same time. And so our language is corrupted. And what happens, of course, when the language is corrupted, what happens? Language is something we use to be rational. See, this is why I call the alternate model rational investing. Language is something we use to facilitate rationality. when the language becomes corrupted, when we think of risk as both the ultimate good and the ultimate evil, our thinking becomes so confused that thinking essentially gets X'd out. And all the intellect of the passive investors, which is considerable, again, not sarcastic, I'm quite sincere, all the intellect of the passive investors gets canceled out. What happens is they use their intellect not to reason, but to rationalize. They use their intellect not to reason, but to rationalize, which takes them backwards, not forwards. So we need to use words more carefully. We need to think about what we really mean when we say risk. And the job that I've set for myself in this podcast is to define risk a little differently so that it's a bit of a semantics game that I'm playing, but with a purpose. The purpose is not to, you know, to waste time or not to win an argument. The purpose is to separate different aspects of the question being examined so that we can understand more clearly the realities. So, what I have come to believe, we are getting compensated for something. You know, when you invest, you clearly are being compensated. You're being compensated for something. You know, if you don't give them your money, you don't get the return. So if I'm going to say you're not being compensated for risk, and I am saying that, I have to answer, well, what is it you're being compensated for? And why do different asset classes provide different returns? And I maintain tentatively, always subject to input from my fellow community members, I maintain tentatively that what you're being compensated for is time. What you are doing when you invest in any asset class, not just stocks, any asset class, is you are giving up use of your money for a certain amount or a certain or an uncertain amount of time. So for example, the asset class that tends to have the lowest return is money markets. Very low return asset class. Well, your money's not at risk. It's true. You know, the passive investing advocates are right. Your money's not at risk. Well, wait a minute. Maybe they're not right. How do you define risk? Let's go with Warren Buffett's definition. Risk is loss. Risk is losing your money. Our money, I've already done a podcast taking the controversial position that stocks are less risky than bonds. Do I dare argue that stocks are no more risky than money markets? In a sense, yes. In a sense, yes. I will argue that. As bizarre as it sounds when you first hear it. Risk, let's go with Warren Buffett's a smart fellow. Let's go with Warren Buffett's definition. Risk is loss. Risk is losing your money. Do you have more chance of losing your money putting it in stocks than you do in a money market? The answer, I think, is no. If you put your money, because for all the reasons the passive investors always assert, if you're simply willing to, it's true, of course, that stocks sometimes go dramatically down. They can go 50% down or whatever. But it's also true, as the passive investing advocates argue, that stock prices always recover. Now, there's no guarantee. There is one scenario where stock prices will not recover in the long run, and that is the U.S. economy goes down, or the U.S. Political system goes down. In that case, all the money in the stock market is worth nothing. That's happened in the world. It could happen here. So there is a risk. But that's true of money markets. If you have your money in a money market and the U.S. government goes down, You're going to lose your money. So I'm not sure that that risk is greater with stocks than it is with money markets. So if you define risk as loss of your assets, I don't think it's an unreasonable statement to say that the risk in money markets is roughly equal to the risk in stocks. Now, there obviously is a big difference. We all know that there's a difference between the two. The difference, I think if we speak carefully, we shouldn't say that the difference is risk. The difference is not that you can lose. The difference is how long the entity to whom you are giving your money will be holding it until you no longer have a loss. In other words, the thing you are compensated for is giving up use of your money. That's why you're being compensated as an investor, no matter what investment class you use. But when you take an investment class like a money market, where you're only giving up the use of the money for literally a day, you know, you can take the money out tomorrow. So all you're promising, you know, when you sign the piece of paper, you know, forming the money market account is I earned this money, I have a right to hold it, but I am giving up the use of that money to you for one day. And in return, you get very little compensation. You do get compensation, though, 1% return, whatever it happens to be. But with stocks, that's not what you're saying. With stocks, what you're saying is, I give up use of this money for an unspecified amount of time. But that time could be very long. It could be one day. You could take your money out of stocks the next day. But the curveball with stocks is it could be 20 years. It could be 20 years before you'll get the same amount of money back in inflation-adjusted terms. Because the day you put your money into stocks, stocks could go down 50% and they may not recover for 20 years. So what I'm trying to say, and it is a bit of a semantics game, I acknowledge, but I think it's a semantics game that would if we all paid attention to it, it would clarify our understanding. It's not semantics for the purpose of fogging up our understanding. It's semantics with the purpose of clarifying our understanding. What I'm saying is we should think of risk and this other concept, the time period for which we give up money, as two different concepts, two different aspects of the question. And on the pure risk meaning loss of assets, money markets, bonds, TIPS, I-bonds, CDs, stocks, all have the same basic risk. The risk that you know, there'll be default. The government will go down and you'll lose your money. But the distinguishing characteristic of these asset classes is, and again, I don't think the distinguishing characteristic is how long it can take for you to be made whole. How long it can take before you can take your money out and get it all back. And with stocks, that is the longest. And I don't think it's right to say that the reason why the return on stocks is the highest is because there's some sort of market forces setting the price. I think what's going on is that the return of stocks is set by the productivity of the U.S. economy, but then the other asset classes don't need to match the return. The return provided by stocks is just set. It's set by by economic forces. It's 6.5. It could change, but that's what it's always. That's what it's been for a long, long time. It's 6.5. But these other asset classes don't need, some of the other asset classes, I think, are set by market forces. Certificates of deposit, the bank can set it wherever they please. But they don't have to match 6.5 because they are willing to give you access to your money on a shorter time frame. So it's you could call that less risk. I understand why people call it that. I'm not you know, trying to be picky about it. But I think it's a cleaner way of thinking, a sharper way of thinking, if you say the risk is the same in all of them. The risk of loss is the same. The distinguishing characteristic is that with the asset classes that pay a higher long-term return, you potentially, not necessarily in every case, but you potentially have to give up access to that money for a longer period of time. That's the downside of stocks. Not that they are riskier. The downside is you have to give up your money for potentially long periods of time. Why do I think this is so important? Well, for one thing, it does away with this crazy idea that risk is good. Because it under this way of thinking about it, risk is the same in all the asset classes. So you're not going to say, oh, I'm behind in my retirement plan, I'll put more money in stocks because they're riskier, which is crazy. You avoid this insanity of the passive investing mindset, which I think is a plus just for your mental health. But of course, the more mental health you have, the better you can think about stocks and the more confident you can be in your investing decisions. But secondly, and more importantly, it puts the focus in the right place. Because now look at what happens. We're not distinguishing the asset classes by risk. We're saying they all have the same risk. CDs, I-bonds, TIPS, bonds, stocks. There are some asset classes where the risk of default is much greater. You know, if you put your money in an emerging market. But in those cases, the work I do is aimed at the average middle class person, and the average middle class person probably shouldn't be taking on those sorts of risks. We should only be investing in things where pretty much sure that we're going to get our money back at some point. And if that's in doubt, maybe what you're doing is not investing but gambling, speculating. So it takes the focus away from this tricky, vague concept of risk, which has been used in all sorts of dangerous ways in the past. And it puts the focus where I think it needs to be, which is, how long is it going to be before you can get your money back? How long are you giving up your money for? You see, the thing you're really being compensated for is not risk. It's giving up control of your money. You earned it. You have a right to it. You're giving it up because somebody's going to use it for some purpose. No matter what investment class you put it in, someone's going to make use of that money to do some good work. Let's hope. And you're helping them out. You're being compensated. They're not saying, you know, how much risk are you? You know, are you a scaredy cat? They don't care. They're just saying, I want this money. And you're giving it to them. But the amount of return you get depends on how long are you willing to give it up. If all you're willing to do is sign a piece of paper to put the money in a money market, all you're giving up is one day. So you are entitled to some compensation, but maybe not that much. What if you're putting it into stocks? Putting it into stocks, you may be giving up use of that money for 20 years. And again, I don't say that that's determined through market forces that you get a higher return. That's determined by the productivity of the U.S. economy. But all of the other asset classes, there may be market forces. I don't think it's so with stocks. But in the others, there are market forces. There are actual people setting the returns rather than economic forces. And those people don't need to match the 6.5 because there is no other asset class that requires that you give up use of your money for such a long period of time. You're not required to give that up with I-bonds or TIPS or certificates of deposit or bonds. Only stocks. Only stocks can you be down for 20 years. Well, you see, that shines a light on what you need to know to become a good stock investor. Now, some would say, Rob, you're pointing stocks out to be bad. Well, no. First of all, I'm just pointing out a reality. Not focusing on the negative. It's a reality. But two, there are times when you get those great returns on stocks, and you don't need to give up control of your money for all that long a time. This is the wonderful side of valuation-informed indexing. You know, I said with stocks you might be giving up access for 20 years, but that's not always true. Now, this is where you have to turn to the stock return predictor. See, this is where the focus should be. The time period. And of course, this is one of the tricks that is always played on us by the stock selling industry. They repeat this mantra. Stocks are always best for the long term. Buy and hold. You'll always do well in the long term. But they never, or very rarely, do they define long term. What is long term? Well, see, this way of defining risk puts the focus on what is the long term. In other words, I'm getting a higher return because I'm giving up my money for a longer period of time, potentially. How long a time am I giving it up for? And then you have to turn to the historical data and find the answer to that question. And what you find is there are some time periods, say when prices are low, like 1982, where you're virtually certain. Let me put it into the calculator and see. We don't have numbers for. I'm going to put in a P10 level of 7, which is where we were in the late 1970s, when the early years of the bull market, when the bull market got started, where we may be in the next 5 years, possibly. We may be heading to 7. So let's take a look. We only have 10-year numbers because the numbers at 5 years are not statistically significant. So we only have 10-year numbers, unfortunately. But that's the best we can do and still be statistically, you know, valid. The worst possible 10-year return, if you put your money in when stocks, when the S&P index is at a P10 level of 7, is the worst. This is not the best. Not the most likely, not the best, the worst. The worst is 11.23%. That's an annualized real return. That's the worst. There's 95% chance it's going to be better than that. That's the worst. The most likely is 17%. The best possible is 23% per year. This is not 10-year returns. Every year for 10 years. So when the worst is 11.23 at 10 years, obviously at 5 years, you know, you're not going to have, at 5 years, you're going to have a positive number. I mean, I don't know what the number would be, but it's not going to be negative. Or at least it's extremely unlikely. Maybe there's a 5%, 6% chance it's going to be negative. So when you buy stocks, if the thing that justifies high returns for stocks is not risk as we define it here, or as I'm defining it in this podcast, but the length of time you're willing to give up your money, that focuses on this question. And you look and you say, wait a minute, if I buy stocks at a P10 level of 7, I get amazing returns, but I'm not really giving my money up for a long period of time. I'm only giving it up for, you know, I could, certainly at a 7, you could have a drop. You could drop down to 5. We've been down to 5. You could drop down to 4, I suppose. Since we went to a higher P10 level than ever seen in history, maybe go to a lower P10 level than ever seen in history in the wake of that. So we could go to 4, or you know, God help us, 3, God help us all. But how long is that going to stay in effect? Either, if we go down to a 4, either the U.S. government is going to collapse, which could happen, and you would lose everything, but you'd lose everything in a money market anyway. Or we are going to see a boom unlike, you know, any, you know, you're going to see it any other time in your life. And you're going to be getting, in 10 years, probably a 17% annualized real return every year. Possibly 23%, and at the worst, 11%. So you're not really giving up control of your money for that long. Now, let's look at what the situation was at the top of the bull market when all of the quote-unquote experts were telling us stocks for the long run, buy and hold, don't change your allocation, blah, 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 blee, blee, blee. Worst possible 10-year return, negative 7% real. That means every year for 10 years, you could lose 7% of your money. 70% loss at the end of 10 years. Most likely, negative 1. So, 10 years, you could be down easily. I mean, most likely you would be down at the end of 10 years. 20 years, it's no longer most likely. The most likely scenario is a gain of 1%. But there's certainly still a possibility you'll be down. The worst possible scenario is a loss of 3% real per year for 20 years. And even at 30 years, you're only at the worst possible scenario is a gain of 2.7%. So if you go, you know, let's say I don't know exactly what the 25-year number is, but since the 20-year number is down 3% per year, annualized loss of 3%, and since the 30-year is a gain of almost 3%, my guess is that the 25-year number is something like dead even. So the point is, if you bought stocks at the top of the bubble when all the experts were telling you that was the thing to do with most of your retirement money, there's a chance, it's not likely, but there's a chance that 25 years later, in the year 2025, you'll just be breaking even. What are your chances compared to TIPS that were paying 4% real? At 50 years out, the worst case scenario for stocks bought at the top of the bubble was 3.6 annualized return. TIPS were paying guaranteed 4. So in 50 years, you haven't caught up with TIPS. In a worst case, I'm not giving the most likely, I'm giving the worst case. You have to go 60 years out to be sure to beat TIPS. They're the worst is 5% real for stocks. So the point is, the way to measure, not risk exactly, at least not the way we're defining it here, but the way to measure your compensation for giving your money up is, how long am I, you know, what am I signing up for? How many years am I giving up use of my money? And with stocks, it's not that stocks are more risky. If you're a long-term investor, which all of the advice, all the information, let's call it, at this site is aimed at long-term investors. None of it is aimed at short-term investors. So I assume that that's the case. If you're a long-term investor, stocks aren't really more risky. It's just that you have to give your money up for longer periods of time. Now, the passive investors make light of that. They just sort of, you know, mention it and then they go on. But the whole point of investing, the whole thing you're being compensated for, is giving up your money for a certain length of time. Giving it up for a longer period of time is worse than giving it up for a short period of time. So we all should be looking at that all the time. It's the most important issue in investing, is how long is it going to take for me to break even on my investment? And a second question is, how long is it going to take for me to have a return on this investment that beats the return on, you know, the safest investment out there? Let's call it I-bonds or TIPS or CDs. How long does it take for me to beat, you know, the safe choice, and how long does it take for me to break even? These are the questions that we should be asking, and we should be investing in stocks to the highest allocation possible, while as long as we can give good answers to those two questions. In other words, when the return on stocks is 17% real, which is far, far, far greater than what you can get from TIPS, you should be heavily invested in stocks. But when the return on stocks is, you know, negative, you should not be heavily invested in stocks. Because it might be true, as the passives point out, that you'll break even if you only hold them for 25 years. Giving up use of your money for 25 years is no small thing. It's a big deal, people. You don't want to give up use of your money for 25 years. Or if you're going to, you sure better get compensated. And all we're talking about is breaking even. To give up use of your hard-earned money for 25 years with a possible scenario being that all you'll do is break even is foolish, in Rob Bennett's opinion. It's foolish. It takes a believer in passive investing to advocate such a foolish decision. And that's what the experts were telling us. The reason I put experts in quotes is because the experts are the people who study passive investing. It's the dominant model. As long as this model is the dominant model, being an expert is a bad thing. You're expert in the wrong stuff. So that's my most recent exploration of the risk concept. I think we need to separate risk, meaning loss of money, which is a more reasonable definition of risk than the one the passive investors use, where risk is sort of good, sort of bad. And then, what we conclude from that is that the risk of all these asset classes is roughly the same, but the difference between them is the length of time for which you're giving up use of your money. And with stocks, that can be very, very, very long, 25 years, 30 years. But it doesn't have to be. You can buy stocks at prices, if you're a little bit patient, you can buy stocks at prices when you will be getting a positive return on your money within 5 years, in all likelihood. And almost certainly within 10 years. And if you do that, you have diminished the risk of stock investing dramatically. That's how you achieve financial freedom early in life, in Rob Bennett's opinion. Good luck with your investing strategies.